Skiva.
Good morning. Welcome to Time Smart Talk with Skiva, News Talk WLOB 1310. We have a very interesting guest this morning. No time for on this day. No time for chit-chat, Deb.
Nothing.
Please join me in our pre-recorded interview recorded yesterday with Glenn Brand, who is the director of Sierra Club here in Maine. Thank you for listening to Tide Smart.
Way up high in Sierra Nevada, close to heaven, that's where I want to be.
Oh boy. Are we trying to put people asleep here, Deb? What is this?
That is Clint Eastwood.
Getting some narcolepsy kicking in here. I'm about to nod off. That is Clint Eastwood singing the classic
Nevada.
Sierra Nevada. What a great intro song for our guest. Please join me in welcoming as Clint Eastwood serenades us in the background. We have Glenn Brand. He's the director of the Maine chapter of the Sierra Club. Have you ever been introduced with Clint Eastwood singing about Sierra Nevada?
I have not.
It's ideal, isn't it?
Well, it's creative.
Well, it is creative, and we'll talk about that, but I'm guessing, is the Sierra Club named, I don't want to get too derailed, from Sierra Nevada? Is that the origin?
Yeah, the roots of the Sierra Club are all the way back, 1892. Legendary conservationist John Muir started the Sierra Club out in California. So it really, its roots are about the environment of the Sierras.
Of course. Well, we want to cover that. But before we do, as kind of our format here, let's spend a moment talking about you and your background and how long you've been here in Maine. And then we'll talk about how you started becoming involved in conservationism and the Sierra Club. But sure. How long have you, where'd you go to school and where'd you grow up and how'd you end up here in Maine?
Well, I'm a Floridian, actually a native Floridian. I grew up in Miami, and you don't meet too many native Floridians.
Well, we're a net exporter from people
exactly.
From Maine to Florida.
Yes.
So you're one of the you've gone
right.
Against the stream.
That's right. I fled, I learned a lot about what we can do to our environment when I lived in Florida. It's where I found my love for the sea, for example.
Right.
But Florida is really a test case in what can go wrong when people aren't planning carefully. And I met my wife when I was in graduate school in Texas. I went to the University of Florida for my undergraduate degree. But in Texas, I met my wife, and that's how I married into Maine, because her mother's family is from Maine. And we had been coming up to Maine forever as a summer resident. And visiting family, and we have a camp up at Moosehead. And then we were always trying to figure out, how are we going to ever live in Maine? How are we going to move to Maine? We love
right.
it. And about 10 years ago, my wife got a job at the University of Southern Maine, and I was able to transfer my at that time, working for the National Sierra Club, was able to move to Maine. So that was 2004.
Are they based in Texas? Or what were you doing in Texas when you were down there?
Oh, I was in graduate school.
I was
in graduate school.
What part of Texas?
In Houston. And so we felt really fortunate to be able to get to Maine, because that was sort of this dream. And luckily, I was working for the National Sierra Club, and they were flexible enough that I could move my job. We were living in Ohio at the time because she had a job there.
Cool. Deb, how many times have I mentioned that Maine, relative to kind of our economic development, which I love here in Maine,
mm-hmm.
How many times have I mentioned that there needs to be a category of economic development and getting people to move back to Maine predicated on what Glenn just mentioned, and that is for the love of a woman
yes.
or for the love of a guy.
Yes.
I was in Atlanta 14 years ago, perfectly content. As a bachelor, I was in sports management. I was an NBA agent. I represented athletes. Had this bachelor pad in Atlanta and pool table, ping pong table, and fairly content.
Air hockey. Don't forget the air hockey.
Oh, yeah. In my Jerry Maguire-esque life. And then I went to a restaurant and ran into a woman named Katie, who subsequently became my wife and the love of my life. And this was in like 1998. And she's like, hey, what do you think about getting married and going up to Maine and having babies? And I'm like, yeah. And she was from Bangor. And the same thing. Here I am in Atlanta going, why wouldn't I want to go to Maine? And there you are having a family connection, the same thing.
Yeah, I meet a lot of people in this.
I know. That's why I'm saying it needs to be, it needs to be almost a focus area, like, you know.
Something on the census.
Something, you know, why are you here? Love of a woman, love of a guy.
There you go.
By the way, we've got Glenn Brand. He's director of Maine Chapter of Sierra Club. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB 1310. So you moved up here in 2004?
Yep.
So let's talk a little bit about when you moved up here, you were involved in the National Sierra Club.
Right.
Talk a little, before we start talking about Maine and what Maine is doing well or what we could do better, but, you know, being involved in conservation, land management, talk a little bit about, you mentioned that the Sierra Club has been around since 1892. It's one of these iconic institutions that everyone's familiar with. You mentioned the Sierra Club, and it has this kind of this indelible kind of genre feeling.
Mm-hmm.
But talk a little bit about how the national organization is set up.
Sure.
How many people are involved? What's the mission statement on a broad sense? And then we'll start talking a little bit about what's going on here in Maine.
Yeah. Well, the National Sierra Club, as I said earlier, started in the 19th century. It really started sort of a mountain hiking club, actually. And in those early days, it became apparent to the folks out in California that some of the most precious, special places were being threatened with development. And, of course, this is prior to any public lands movement or the creation of the national park or anything like park system or anything like that. That concept wasn't around. And in fact, the early work of the Sierra Club was to create that, which is now a very widely admired world idea. It started the entire movement. It led directly to the creation of the national park system in the U.S., which spread all around the world. And it really is focused, I think, iconically on Yosemite. And that's why if you ever see Sierra Club logo, if you can picture it, you'll see Half Dome in that in that picture with a big redwood. So that's how it started. And it always started off as a volunteer organization. And that's another thing that I think is really important about the Sierra Club is that it pioneered what now we think of as grassroots organizing. There really wasn't such a category before, and the idea that citizens could come together and talk to, there's always been organizing, but not on behalf of the environment. And that really changed the world as we look back on it now. And the club has this tradition of volunteer leadership and volunteer participation. It's a unique organization in that it's entirely run by volunteers. The board of directors on the national level are all volunteers. Our board here in Maine are all volunteers. We're very light on staff. For example, in Maine, it's me and one other person. And everything else is done by volunteers. And that really has its roots in the beginning of the club. In the beginning, the club really focused on land conservation. And then it started into the 40s and 50s to turn to pollution issues as those became more apparent to more folks. And through the 60s, it became a political organization more and more, in that we were not just working on the environmental conservation side, but trying to elect public officials that we thought would help accomplish our goals.
And also a lot of legislative issues and EPA and DEP and all that stuff that creates the framework for public enforcement policy, I guess.
Oh, yeah. We led to the creation of the landmark national laws on the environment, you know, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the Wilderness Act, all that stuff that took place in the 60s was in part the result of leadership from the Sierra Club, not alone, but important. And then, you know, finally institutionalized under Richard Nixon, which a lot of people forget, the EPA and a lot of other, a lot of important.
You know, Tricky Dick doesn't get some of the credit. You know, the final bill he signed into law before he took off in the helicopter back to San Clemente?
Tell me.
Title IX.
Oh, yes.
Equal rights. And Yeah, he was clearly pretty shady when it came yes. to the politics of the realm.
But he did some good stuff.
But he did some really interesting stuff, and people don't give him credit for whether yeah. the EPA or Title IX. And
the Endangered Species Act.
Yeah. And Nixon, you know, God, Ehrlichman and Haldeman and Dean. Oh, do you remember his secretary's name? Oh, come on. This wow. should be taught in
this
every
should
school.
Be Rosemary somebody.
Rosemary Wood.
Wood.
Yeah.
Duh.
I mean, duh, come on. That's Aunt Rosemary. I'm kidding. I'm no relation. But anyhow, I could talk about Nixontonian days in San Clemente in the good old days of Richard Nixon.
You know, what I think is even more important from my point of view about Nixon is not so much his individual leadership on this, which was present, but it reflected a time which is where Republicans and Democrats were really unified on environmental protection.
Yeah.
And that has broken down, starting in the 80s under the sort of Gingrich.
Things became polarized where
on a lot of issues.
Regardless, but, you know, science became secondary to ideology and special interests. But back then, it really was more rooted in, yeah, this makes sense. Right. Let's make political issues some other kind of things.
And the business case for environmental protection was really clearly understood in a way that, you know, is not as apparent now to a lot of folks.
Yeah, Deb, what's Richard Nixon's middle name?
Milhouse.
Got it. I didn't see that coming.
Didn't see it?
No, I didn't see you getting that one. By the way, we have Glenn Brand here. He's the director of the Maine chapter of Sierra Club. Talk a little bit about, yeah, when people mention conservation, it's a broad kind of amorphous term. Relative to the Sierra Club and relative to public policy, how would you kind of define conservation in both the original intent, because back in 1892, when the Sierra Club was formed, obviously the country looked much different. There was, you know, railway and there was population migration going from east to west. And as you mentioned with Yosemite and some of these great parks and you know, Grand Canyon. But from then to now, conservation has changed. There's it's a different dimension. And now that in the year 2015, you know, the core settlement areas are there. There's government land that has kind of government protection. There's national parks. How do you define, as an organization in your own personal view, what is conservation and how the public should think about it mm-hmm. relative to day-to-day life?
Well, conservation, you're right, is a really overarching, broad concept. Again, it really started in conserving land that was special to people for all kinds of reasons. Nowadays, I think we haven't lost that definition or that meaning. You know, that's still an important part of what we're doing. You know, after all, the mission statement of the Sierra Club is to explore, enjoy, and protect our environment. And so there's no getting around, and nor do we, you know, and I think we need to celebrate the roots of the club and its mission, which is in preserving important landscapes. Imagine what the country, for example, would be like without the national park system. Imagine what Maine would be like without Acadia, for example. If that institution hadn't been there, there would have been no way for the Rockefellers to donate that land to make the park. You know, it's really a part of the American character, these kinds of landscapes. But that's only one part of it. Conservation also encompasses a way of thinking about ecology, really, that all things are connected. John Muir had a very famous quote that's used a lot, which is, he said, when you pick up one thing, you find it hitched to everything else. And that's a real simple way of explaining what ecology means. And I think what happened is that as the conservation movement broadened in the 50s and 60s to establish these landmark laws, it really became more about pollution issues. People had become, you know, famously, the Cuyahoga River caught on fire in 1969. This was in Cleveland,
Ohio. Yeah.
And people, this apocalyptic kind of biblical apocalyptic image really shocked people. There had been a lot of these kinds of things happening, but this one image, I think, really seared into people's imagination.
I grew up in Needham, Mass,
right,
on the Charles River,
right,
which people are familiar with the Charles, primarily in Cambridge and Boston, where it's wide and there's sculling and all this. But as the Charles River winds through West Roxbury and then Newton, my father owned a company on the Charles River. On the opposite side, this was in the 60s, there was a big either chemical or textile manufacturing plant. And every day you could literally see these 6-8-inch pipes leading into the river where the nastiest pollution would go right into the Charles River. And it, to me, looking back in the 60s and the 70s and looking back, I don't know how, and it's great that all this reform happened and there were pollution acts and EPA and all this other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But before that happened, what was the thinking, right, of a manufacturing plant or a local government that brought about that we needed to legislate, hey, putting toxic chemicals in a river is a bad thing? It just seems so absurd that, right, we even needed that kind of regulation. And those were just crazy times.
Yeah, and I think it's actually, we have an analogous period. I mean, it's very clear to us now that unrestrained, unconstrained pollution is just a way of transferring the cost of pollution from a private, in this case, say, a company,
right,
to the public. So it's not like there's no cost. It just gets transferred. And so I think what we're seeing now is a very similar thing in that right now there is no cost to anybody to pollute our air with carbon dioxide, with global warming pollution. And I think we're going to look back in 20 years and we're going to say the same thing. You mean there was a time when you could actually just pollute as much carbon dioxide as you want?
Okay, I'm whispering here, Glenn, because I don't want Deb to hear us.
Okay, go ahead.
But I had last week or the week before the head of UMaine's climate department here. And
oh,
we
good.
Were talking about isotopes in Antarctica.
Oh, boy.
It's a pet peeve and pet project of mine.
Yeah.
I'm a climate change denier. I think
you are?
Well, yeah, Deb, I wasn't talking to you. Okay, Deb, I'm holding up my sheet here. You know, you can turn your mic down here.
Okay.
Deb is part of that tribe of people,
mm-hmm,
who aren't quite sure that humans are having this impact on the environment. She said it's cows, there's some sort of methane thing, or there's natural weather cycles. The concept between weather and climate is something that Deb doesn't recognize. It was only weeks ago that I convinced her that gravity was a real thing.
Right.
We went
through
a whole physics thing, and we went through Isaac Newton. We brought in all the stuff.
Right.
But I agree with you. I interviewed a year ago this guy named Dr. Lown. He's like in his early 90s. He won the Nobel Peace Prize for inventing the defibrillator. So he's a doctor, and he lives in Newton.
Really?
And he was also involved with Doctors Against Nuclear Proliferation.
Yeah.
And when I talked to him about nuclear stuff, he's like, the number one threat to our world isn't nuclear arms or nuclear bombs. Something goes off, and, it'd be horrible, and, a million people may die. It's the climate. Anyone who says otherwise is just an idiot. And he's like 90-something years old,
mm-hmm,
and Deb hung up on him. I'm kidding.
But I did not.
You didn't, because you weren't rude to him.
Right.
But what you just said, it just seems so clear,
right,
that 20 or 30 years, I think the other thing is, I've often said, do you ever watch Star Trek as a kid? You
grew up watching?
Yeah. I think that if we want to get cues into the future, I'm not so much a Lost in Space guy, although that was a great show. But all we got to do is look forward and go, they had some clever fictional insights that I think we can learn from. Number one, we'll all be wearing the same outfits.
Yes, jumpsuits.
In the future,
yes.
Because when we go to other planets, you want to look the same, right?
It's already started with jeans.
Yeah. So the second thing is, I think we're going to look back and go, tobacco is a crazy thing. How did a society, do people put cancer sticks in their mouths, put them on fire, and then the other thing, which is a little more nuanced, is boxing, because I've done written papers on it. And if let's say Tom Brady, who is in the middle of Deflategate, and that's a really big deal, but when he gets back on the field, if Tom Brady is tackled, right, and Giselle is watching, and the kids and America's watching because he's such a great guy, and if he hits his head on the AstroTurf, and there's turf, and then there's foam underneath, you can hear the announcers in the stands and the up and oh my God, Tom Brady is down. Hold on, medical people are coming out. He hit his head. And we look at that with such reverence of we think he may have a concussion. But in the average boxing match, without helmets, unless it's amateur, but in professional boxing, they pound each other hundreds of times. There's 40 or 50 recorded concussions in every boxing match. And America looks at that as, hey, that is great gladiator fun. It's just this weird, uncivilized right. thing.
Right.
So tobacco, boxing, and this climate change thing.
Right.
See how I looped it all together,
yeah.
Deb?
Yeah.
That was very well done.
They make you look back. And when you look right. into, yeah, whether you look in the future from that perspective looking back or look in the past in the 60s and go, the toxic materials, paint manufacturers, automotive, the whole Norma Ray stuff, or yeah. what's her name, that made the movie about...
Sally Field?
No, she was the flying nun.
Aaron Brockovich.
You look back and you go, how can we not learn from that? And...
Well, we are. I think we are learning.
Slowly, but there's a time value that's serious.
Well, that is what makes this issue of climate change a little different, or very different, is there's an urgency. You can't really, I mean, there's always damage for all of these things. The longer these things go on, the more damage. But I think the larger concept is we owe it to future generations. I mean, it's a kind of odd problem in which climate change, we're experiencing the problems now, or we're paying the cost now. It is distributed widely to everybody, and some people are experiencing those costs more than others and those harms. But this is a problem that gets worse over time, and so there's a built-in time lag.
You know, right.
Carbon dioxide stays in the atmosphere for 100 years, and it builds up. And so we really need – we're in a unique position. One thing to – take the pipe out or put a smoke, do something with a smokestack, and we feel those improvements relatively immediately.
Or scrub the air in some way and turn it from a gas to a solid, then bury it safely or do something, right?
You got it. We have immediate benefits. That's not the case with climate change. And that time lag makes it particularly challenging because you're asking people to think about discounting, in effect.
Right.
Which is a really hard concept for a lot of people to think about beyond their own, you know, family budgets, right? I mean, people get it with a car, right? It declines in value, but reverse discounting is a much more difficult idea. And on a societal scale, that's the big challenge. You know, we need to make real changes. Now, the important thing about climate change is to dwell not so much on the problems, which are real, but to talk about the opportunities, because our current energy system is no dream. We are incredibly dependent on other people for oil, which causes all kinds of problems, political problems, military problems.
And dinosaurs. We're very dependent upon the old dinosaur fuel.
That's right. That's right. I'm from the oil. But the cost of energy, the insecurity of the problems, and Maine experiences this in particular, because we're very unusual in the United States. We're the most oil or heating oil dependent state. And of course, you know, all of our transportation for the most part is based on oil. We don't suffer from coal pollution as much as, you know, most of the country, which produces it. We still are the so-called tailpipe of the nation. So we do get this problem coming across from the Midwest. So why asthma rates are so high in Maine, even though we don't have the factories here, for example. We have a lot of problems with the current energy system. So it's not like, oh, things are so great. In fact, we're paying a lot of costs, literally, for the insecurity of being completely dependent on fossil fuels. So, you know, I think the important part of this is not only do we have to talk about the problems and the threats but we got to talk about the opportunities, the economic opportunities for transforming our fossil fuel dependent economy to a clean energy economy are tremendous. We're already seeing that with the growth of the solar industry in the last decade.
By the way, we have Glenn Brand in the studio as director of the Maine chapter of the Sierra Club. Did you happen to notice the most energy-efficient building in Maine as you drove in?
I did, and I was hoping you'd bring that up. I live very close to here, in fact.
Fantastic.
And so I drive by it all the time, particularly take my daughter to school. I'd love to hear more about that. I've been meaning to
well,
take a tour of it.
Afterwards, I'll give you a quick tour. Yeah. No furnace, no boiler, no fossil fuels. Yeah. It is the Viridescent building here on the campus here at TideSmart. And the interesting thing is it's the only, I believe, net positive building in Maine. There may be one other.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it works here in Maine and in most kind of power grids is if you have solar, you have to connect to the electrical authority, in this case Central Maine, mm-hmm. and then basically you get credits for the electricity you're providing. And because we're all on one campus and we have solar in the logistics center and solar on the Viridescent House, virtually the whole campus is solar powered. So the electricity, the lights, the amplification in the radio studio, it's all clean solar.
It's all good.
It's all fantastic.
Right. But so why did you do that? There's an extra cost, the payback. I'd love to hear about
there's the payback. A significant cost,
yeah.
And I would love to hear about the payback also. That'll happen in about 30 years.
Mm-hmm. You mean for all the campus-wide stuff?
For all the campus-wide stuff.
Right.
You know, we've put in LED lights, new light packages, mm-hmm. which are more expensive, and there's kind of a rebate program with Maine Energy.
Right.
We have water fountains for refilling water bottles, and we have what was 5 years ago the fourth, maybe the third, electric vehicle charging station in the whole state.
Right.
And then we added another. And I think now there may be 20. There's a few more. But you go to California, which I was there 2 days ago talking about Sierra, and you go to a beach parking lot, and there's an electric vehicle charging lot with 50 electric vehicle charging stations.
Yep.
And in that's a whole other discussion about EV, in that it's a chicken or the egg thing. If you don't have the infrastructure, it's really hard, especially in a wide state like Maine, where there's not a lot of density in terms of business and residential stuff.
Right. Of course, 80 years ago, there wasn't a gas station on every corner either.
I know. So you have to start somewhere. Someone had to say at one point, well, we're going to get rid of the horses, and I'm going to be the first to get a Model T, but there's no – it evolves.
Yep.
But with the building that we built, this was another kind of really interesting learning for me. The key to high-performing building and energy-efficient building is one, the energy source, which in this case is solar, and we have two small heat pumps that both cool and heat, which are it's an efficient technology.
Yep.
But more than anything else, it's the envelope where you contain the air. So you need a slab, so there's no basement. The slab has three or four 4-inch holes through the slab where the utilities come up. So you don't need to put holes in the wall, because any kind of entry point to the building creates access for air, cold air, hot air in the summer.
Right.
And there's 14,000 pounds of insulation. So the walls are almost 2 feet thick. The slab is almost 2 feet thick. The roof is almost 2 feet. But here's the weird thing. When the builder came to me and said, well, you know, you have the window and the door package, and you need high-performing, triple-glazed windows and doors.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, that sounds good. And I go, where do we get those from? And the builder and the architect said, they come from Lithuania.
Right.
First of all, I had to look at a map to find out where Lithuania is, because right away, intuitively, it sounds like it's far away. Deb, have you ever, you ever been to Lithuania?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, I meant to go.
But if I go, I'm going to tour one of those plants.
I know. So all of our windows, and they're thick, designed almost like airline doors, in that there are 8 locking mechanisms around the perimeter. So when the doors are closed, it's almost completely airtight. So as long as you can immobilize the air, and you have an air handler so people don't run out of oxygen, then it takes very little energy to either get it up to 70 degrees in the winter
mm-hmm.
or bring it down to 70 degrees, because the air, it's only when you're introducing new hot air or cold air that you introduce the inefficiency.
Right.
So for this building, when you're inside, it's almost soundproof. And for the first few weeks when we had folks working over there, I don't want to say there were cases of insanity, but there was a little bit of discomfort because it's so quiet. And we're just not used to. In fact, that was one of the funny things. We had our guest a couple weeks ago from Antarctica. He said it's insanely quiet when you can hear your heartbeat when you're in Antarctica, because it's the complete absence of any other sound. So the sky looks different. Right. And he was mentioning you look at objects in front of you, and because of the optics and the clarity, you don't know if it's 50 feet away or 50 miles. It's like this weird visual thing in auditory. Right. But for the building, how we can't produce windows and doors in the U.S. seems bizarre.
Of course we can. We will at some point when the market
is created. But right now there's a greater market at Lowe's and Home Depot and with building companies to build cheaper materials. Right. And that's also tied into kind of a financial system that is set up where our banking approach, our financing approach for structure is in like 20 and 30 year loan increments. And so all the banks care about is, will their asset be around for 30 years?
Right.
Introducing a Lithuanian window that could be around for 80 years.
Right.
Banks don't care about that.
Right.
They'd rather have, you know, Anderson windows, which I'm sure they're lovely windows.
Sure.
But they cost one-fourth what a Lithuanian window costs. But we need people to get turned on to the whole Lithuania thing.
Yeah, to make these things here. I mean, you know, you're talking about super-duper advanced technology that is around. But if you think about the average Mainer, lives in a house that is heated by oil, that is not insulated sufficiently.
Maybe 100 years old, maybe 80 years old.
Exactly. Drafty old houses. And we have the most to gain by cheap energy efficiency. I mean, no place where the payback be as short and the benefit would be as great on energy efficiency. You know, we're talking about insulation stuff. We're not talking about fancy Lithuanian windows. I mean, that stuff is tremendous, and that's where it's going to go. But, the cheapest form of energy, of course, is the energy you don't waste, right? So that's what energy efficiency is about, and it's not really as sexy as solar energy or wind, but is absolutely the most important thing. And that's really where our policies, if you're talking about what's most important in Maine, energy efficiency policies would be the top of the list for the reasons we talked about.
You would think, you know, Deb, if one of us in the room ran for state political leadership position, that would be a good platform, wouldn't it?
Well, it would be a great platform. I just don't know if we could win.
I tried and I didn't win.
So I
think we've proved that. I know, but you're not on the same energy team.
No.
You may have been on another team. Deb was on the machine gun under the bed team. That's how Deb rolls. Everyone, we're not going into gun rights, Deb. Right now, some of our conservative listeners got all excited, like, oh, thank God they're going to be talking about guns instead of like energy. But the energy stuff threatens the planet, not just on our creature comfort, temperature, agriculture, jobs. It's, you know, it's the biggest issue the Pentagon, the military is facing, because a destabilized world means bad things in terms of geopolitics. So what's happening in the climate isn't like, well, you know, the weather changes a little bit and it may be a little toasty. It will, unless there's changes, destabilize every part of our lives.
It's happening already. And, you know, the most vulnerable places of the planet are the ones who are going to experience it first. You know, we're seeing this in all kinds of places.
Lower-lying islands and countries are already vulnerable.
In the Mideast, there's the droughts there have had political implications. But the superstorms, richer countries like ours, developed countries, are more resilient, right? We suffer these, you know, think about Katrina. It's actually 10 years now. Since Katrina happened, the hurricane in New Orleans, we can bounce back from those things, even though it's hard. But places that are less developed, people flee.
Right.
And where do they flee? Well, they flee into other countries, and then that creates instability. So the military actually takes climate change quite seriously. A quick Google to see what the military's reports on climate change are pretty scary, actually. These are not tree huggers.
They're not tree huggers, and they're not politicians. They're very, very pragmatic.
Right.
You know, they're just focused on when you look at both what's happening in the Antarctic and you look at what's happening. I was just in Iceland 2 months ago, and I visited a couple of the glaciers.
I'd love to go to Iceland.
Oh, direct flights from Boston to Reykjavik, and $99, this new airline. And it wasn't like I wouldn't have paid $200 to go to Iceland.
Yeah.
But the $99 thing, I took my son and we went. I mean, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
But you go to these areas where you can see in the rock formations where, the, you know, you go with a guide. And the person says, you know, the 60-year-old guy I was with said, hey, for my whole life, I've never seen this area of Iceland, which looks a little bit like Mars, up until the last 5 years. And you can see where the glacier has retreated in just years, where for thousands, millions of years, glaciers covered these areas. Right. And they're like, it's a big deal. And when you look at whether it's Greenland, which, by the way, is very icy, and Iceland is very green, very counterintuitive, really throws you off.
Yes.
But water level, the water levels are rising. Acidity is rising, which is really impacting food source in the ocean and the whole ecosystem.
Oh,
there.
A direct threat in Maine. The acidification of the oceans from the carbon dioxide that's going up in the air is coming back down to the water and making our oceans more acidic. And that's a direct threat to our fishing industry.
Yeah.
You know, the clam and mussel industry is already super weighed down because of that, because the organisms can't make thick shells as much.
I grew up in Boston. Yeah. Cape Cod doesn't have any more cod. It's like they're going to have to change the name. They're thinking it's going to...
I don't think they're going to change the name, though.
Really? You think it'll just be forever Cape Cod, generations from now? Where's the cod?
Yeah.
It could be Cape Sandy. Cape Sandy.
Could be Cape Steve-O.
It could be. I just want people to listen. It's like I don't have a political... This is the crazy thing. By the way, we have Glenn Brand here, and he is the director of Maine Chapter of Sierra Club. I don't have a political horse in the race, and I don't know how this issue that we've just kind of talked about has been politicized. Mm-hmm. To me, it's just about science, you know? And when we had the head of the climate change group say, yeah, he goes to Antarctica every couple of years, and they've got studies, and they now have the technology to look at ice core samples that go down miles into the ice sheet and study isotopes. And I may not be able to spell isotope, but I recognize and respect the science. And when they say they can look back millions of years with some degree of like precise accuracy, and they can show the amount of carbon in the atmosphere, and they can show the mineral components of water that was frozen. And when they say... Yeah, when you look at the last 60 years, industrialized explosion growth here in the U.S. and around the world, it's not a weather pattern. There's something profoundly happening. Why there's a group of people there in other places that are like, well, I think we're in a cycle, and I think maybe things are going to change. Because 20, 30 years from now, I am going to haunt Deb. And at that point, you know, we're already old people, but we're going to be like super old in like 30 years.
In rocking chairs.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I am going to come to your nursing home from my nursing home. I am getting a nursing home transportation order put in.
Okay.
Take me to Deb's nursing home.
Okay.
And I'm going to roll in my nursing home wheelchair, find you 30 years from now. It's like, damn it, Deb. It's 140 degrees here in Maine. I told you for 5 years this was a real deal.
I may agree with you at that point. Who knows?
But the idea is change has to happen today. It's not going to help us when we're 86 and our grandkids are, you know, living in a desert. It's going to be the apocalypse. And it's not going to happen that directly. But in the next 100 years, it'll be unbelievable change. So
and you know what I think it's important as always is to bring it not just focus on the problem. I mean, the problem is real, and I don't debate the science stuff anymore. It's a waste of time. So I think the important thing is, you know, what are the right solutions? You know, where do we get the maximum benefits, the health benefits, the economic benefits? That's what we really should be talking about. Because in 100 years, yes, the problem if we don't do anything is going to be worse. But in 100 years, if we do a lot, we will have solved a lot of enormous problems that we're confronted with now and create entire new industries, new jobs, you know, cleaner air. That's the stuff I'd like to focus on because, you know, a lot of people think about environmentalists, and it's true. There is a part that is true, that we fight bad stuff and spend a lot of time protesting and opposing. For me, you know, that's got to be, you know, some of that is necessary. What the percentage is, I don't know, 20%, 30%. But I really like to spend my time on the solution side of things. That's where it makes a difference in people's lives, in ordinary people's lives. That's, I think, our responsibility is to really focus on the solution side.
I agree. We have Glenn Brand here. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLAB 1310 AM. Glenn is the director of the Maine chapter of Sierra Club. In our last few minutes, Glenn, let's bring it back to Maine little bit. Talk a little bit about the Maine chapter of the Sierra Club. And by the way, I should mention that the website for the national organization, I'm sure there are ways to kind of tab through, is sierraclub.org. But talk a little bit as an organization, what are the focus areas here in Maine for Sierra Club? And talk a little bit about our kind of legislative climate here in Maine. And then I want to talk about some specific things like the proposal for the national park and some other things that are kind of specific to Maine.
Right. So the Sierra Club's main chapter started in the early 90s. It was actually before that. It was a part of a larger New England state chapter. We have over 14,000 members and supporters in the state. We're one of the largest grassroots volunteer organizations, if not the, on the environmental side. We have been working on about three priorities, I would say, in the last few years. One is on climate, and I'll talk about our local climate action team program, which is our solution work in Maine. We're also working on conservation. We're protecting the Maine woods from various threats. There's some hot button issues that that we work on quite a bit, like tar sands, which you may have covered in this before. You know, the proposed east-west highway, those kinds of threats. There's a proposed dredging in Penobscot Bay that we have concerns about. So we work on some of those things. We're the only environmental organization that really works on transportation issues in the state at any great depth. We're particularly excited about reviving a passenger train system in Maine. Which we think is one of the solutions to our transportation problems. We're interested in electric vehicles as a solution here. The most important work that we're doing on climate now really has to do with our main climate action team program, or CAT CATS. And that's an effort that started right after the historic climate action march that took place in New York City. We chartered 5-6 buses to bring Mainers down to the march. People came back all fired up. They wanted to do something about climate. And that's why we started the program. And so it really just is an effort to support citizens to organize in their communities to implement and adopt clean energy solutions like community solar farms, like municipal installed solar, energy efficiency outreach programs, even stuff like, you know, better recycling and compost program, you know, other things too. And people can find out about that and how to get involved by looking at sierraclub.org/Maine. And there's a link to all of that work. We did a big conference at Bowdoin last year, brought together over 120 people to talk about these things. We had workshops and trying to model what other municipalities are doing and towns are doing so people can adopt those things. The reason we're doing this is not just to improve the communities in Maine. We are doing it for that reason. But the other reason we're doing it is because we want to make progress on the solution side in a political climate which is now pretty hostile to it. And that's
pretty hostile. Pretty hostile.
Pretty hostile is understating it.
Yep.
So the LePage administration, in particular, has been opposed to taking action on climate, on clean energy policy. Has been downright hostile to a lot of.
Caring about people. Again, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but yeah.
Right, you did. And so we're not going to wait for Augusta. You know, we tried our best to elect, we thought, a pro-environment candidate. We lost. We strongly backed Mike Michaud in that race. And people voted the way they voted. And I don't know that they really voted for anti-environmental policies. I don't believe that. But that is what we're getting. And so we're not content to wait for Augusta, and we're not content to wait, for that matter, wait for Congress. We need to start taking action here. And one of the things that we're doing is trying to build momentum. So, for example, if you're talking about a number of communities investing in community solar projects or solar projects, then those people are highly invested in pro-solar policies. And that's what's going to really change and build the constituency for change for clean energy, say, in Augusta.
Right.
So, you know, that's the thing we're really excited about. We're going to do our second annual conference on this, the main grassroots climate conference at Unity College this year. It's going to be October 17th, Saturday. It's either 17th or 18th. I've forgotten now.
That's a beautiful campus.
Beautiful place.
Beautiful place.
And people can find about it on our website. So those are some of our priorities and what we're up to.
Let me run by the Steve-O hypothesis on mean. Deb, this is where we don't allow Deb to jump in because she just doesn't believe in any of it. I'm kidding, Deb. If you want to jump in.
Whatever, it's cool. Go ahead.
It's cool. I don't want to hurt your feelings with your machine guns and all your other stuff. So, you know, I travel all over. Last week, I was in Cheyenne, Wyoming for 2 days, Denver. Where else was I? Chicago. I spent 5 days in San Diego, Coronado. I'm actually going to China, which I want to talk to you about next month.
Yeah.
And I'm going to Hong Kong and then Singapore and then Macau, which has its own unbelievable pollution issues. I've already got my little gas mask ready.
Yep.
I'm going to be one of those guys running around with my little gas mask.
You won't be the only one.
I know. So, but Maine is an unbelievable place. My theory is a couple hundred years ago is one of the first settlements in America, you know. A group of people came up to Maine. Maine is great, you know. And back then, there was no knowledge of planes, trains, fiber optics, cars, infrastructure. You know, it was just this big, beautiful place. So people kind of spread out, and we ended up with approximately 488 municipalities in some unincorporated areas and some Indian tribes. So there's about 500 local fiefdoms around Maine, and we only have 1.3 million people. And my analysis of Maine, which impacts conservation, impacts energy policy and everything else, is we as an infrastructure, a physical infrastructure versus political or economic, we lack the density and the efficiency to economically compete in a global market or just a U.S. economy, that we can't get out of our own way. And people are spread out around the whole state because back then, 200 years ago, 180 years ago, you know, textile, some agriculture, some lumber industries, old economy, Maine stuff. But if you and I were around 180 years ago, we would live out in the middle of like a very rural area of Maine. And, you know, we would have a house, some other neighbors have a house, your family grows up here, I trade you two horses for this, maybe you fish if you're in the coastal area, I build you a boat. Mm-hmm. And the trading area was a 5 mile, or however long you and your horse could go in a day.
Right.
And so everyone spread out. But today and going forward in the global economy, you know, the new economy demands density. And if you don't have density, you don't have efficiency. And if you don't have people clustered in areas, you can't provide educational excellence. You can't provide healthcare excellence. You can't provide a density of skilled job because there's not enough people. And it involves conservation, but it also involves land management.
Mm-hmm.
We, in my opinion, need to have some consolidation. It's happened naturally, but it's happening painfully slow, where there's 108 communities in Maine that I identified a couple of years ago in a report. It's not just that they're insolvent, but for all practical purposes, the new economy isn't going to touch these places. Technology, you know, even if they have broadband, programmers aren't moving there. Intel isn't moving there.
Right.
And if this was in the 1880s, these places would become ghost towns kind of organically. You know, the mine shuts down. Right. Nobody says, hey, stay where you are. We're going to subsidize you in perpetuity.
Right.
Maine, in my opinion, needs to be smart about the new economy. And that involves land. It involves all the asphalt we have from the state. It has to do with our transportation system. And if you have a community with 100 people and you have two bridges and you have water treatment and you have all these policy standards,
right,
you can't pay for it because there's no underlying economy.
Mm-hmm.
And has either the Sierra Club or you looked at kind of the political structural setup of our state,
right,
or is that something that's too much of a hot button issue?
Well, I think I know the report you're referring to, by the way. It was the Envision report or whatever it's called a couple of years ago about that issue and the inefficiency of the way, you know, the counties and the multiple overlapping.
There's redundancy. Yeah, redundancy. And for every mile you put between a person in healthcare or a mile between a person or family in education or a mile between, you're adding inefficiency. And then you have to, you throw in public safety and you put in salty roads for the wintertime.
Yep,
and
sure.
We can't compete because it's a physics thing. It's time and space. Right. And so we can have the best philosophy in the world, but we are so spread out that we cannot economically compete.
Maine's not unique that way. I mean, there's a lot of rural communities. They face those issues. From our point of view, you know, we really don't take a position on the way governments are structured. But I would say that we take a great interest in smart growth land use policies. And that does touch on what you're talking about. So there are countless ways in which sprawl, for example, on poorly planned development and exasperates these problems you're talking about. Subsidizing through infrastructure, people relocating further out from town centers and city centers and encourage the economic abandonment of these town centers.
Right.
So it makes, as you say, it makes it really difficult to provide public transportation in those circumstances. So that is something we do care about. We do think it is an important thing to do, particularly in a rural state. What I'm referring to as sprawl is, I think, of a larger problem than, you know, a rural community. I think rural communities can be vibrant and healthy. They certainly are in many places. But subsidizing or planning for sprawl really produces the problems you're talking about in part. So we do think about that, and we advocate for smart growth land use policy.
Final question for Glenn Brand. He's the director of the Maine chapter of the Sierra Club. You can find out more information at sierraclub.org. And then I think there's a click through to
/Maine
to look at what's happening in Maine and how you can volunteer
and become a member.
And there's fundraising events and how you can become a member, which I think is a great organization.
Yeah.
One of the best examples of conservation that I believe, and I want to get your quick thoughts, New York City, Central Park. Despite all the pressures from all the developers over, whether it was the last two centuries, that wanted to build on Central Park, the thoughtfulness of public policy to say, the foresight to say, we're going to carve out this area, and it's a huge area, and despite all the pressures of, hey, if we cut off that little piece and build a high rise, we can have $10 million. If we cut off that little piece, but when you look at the vibrancy of New York, Central Park, just the land in the middle of it is such a unique thing.
Sure.
What do you think of Central Park? You a fan?
Oh, of course. I love New York. And the larger point that you make is that kind of thinking we already have. We already understand what our landscapes would be like.
The balance of space and
people
and nature.
Just imagine, would anyone want to destroy a national park? I mean, the idea of it is unthinkable for good reason.
Right.
It helps shape our culture and make our lives better. But that's the exact same thinking that we need. We have that foresight. We've demonstrated in those examples. We need that foresight to deal with problems like climate change.
Absolutely. Well, I'd love for you to come back sometime. This is really fascinating.
Sure.
And
love to.
Thank you for joining us today, Glenn Brand.
Glad to be here. Thanks.
You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. Look forward to having you back next week. Have a nice weekend.